This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Welcome to Friday. What a week. It kicked off with a big bang.
And they are off. Woo!
With the 118th running of the Boston Marathon, of course, that went off without a hitch on Monday and with tremendous emotion.
Whip Kozlowski wins the Boston Marathon!
Emotion for a lot of reasons, including the fact that for the first time in 31 years, an American man won the men's race.
The bomb happened, and I'm every day since. I said, I want to come back and win it.
Also this week, the Patrick administration places new restrictions on the powerful hydrocodone-based painkiller, Zohydro.
There is a crisis of overuse and misuse of opiate prescription drugs that oftentimes can lead to the use of heroin.
Also, Boston's Children's Hospital computer networks have been under attack, allegedly by members of the hacker group Anonymous.
Anonymous and the American people will not tolerate this abuse of our children and will retaliate using whatever means necessary in order to protect our fellow citizens.
Plus, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren's new book hits the stands, fueling speculation that she might be considering a presidential run in 2016.
You can ask this a whole lot of different ways, but the key is I'm not running for president.
So there is much to discuss in our Week in Review with our panelists today, and they are Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to have you back, Jeff.
Hi, Meghna.
Also with us today, Jim Sturgis, director of the Pioneer Institute. Good to see you as always, Jim.
Good to be with you.
All right, so let's start off with the big news that was, of course, on Monday, the Boston Marathon, and that surprise win by Meb Keflezighi. He's an American who emigrated from Eritrea when he was just 12 years old with his family. He grew up in San Diego, California.
I'm blessed to be an American, and God bless America, and God bless Boston. This is a special day on Patriots Day, and, you know, it happens in God's time. I tried it, but it cannot be a better day than this day.
Well, Meb Keflezighi not only set a personal record, a personal best when he ran on Monday, he also ran with the names of the four people killed both in the marathon bombings and the manhunt last year. Martin Richard, Crystal Campbell, Liu Lingzi, and MIT police officer Sean Collier, who was allegedly shot by the Tsarnaev brothers on that Friday. So, Jeff, let's start with you first. What struck you about the running of this year's marathon and sort of the overall feeling and meaning of the day?
I think it's not just that an American won for the first time in all those years, but that an immigrant was the winner. What could be a more perfect bookend, a more perfect rebuttal to the whole Tsarnaev hostility to the country that took them in than to hear somebody like Meb Keflezighi say, you know, God bless America, I love America, this is my country. That, more than anything else, it seems to me, was what really was so special about the fact that he, of all people, was the winner. To have come from a country like Eritrea, which has been decimated by so much violence and bitterness and hostility and to a certain extent Islamist awfulness, wanted to come to this country, made it here, and then this on top of it, and on the first anniversary of the marathon bombing, which was stood for exactly the opposite of all, I don't think it could have been more perfect.
I actually think that's a wonderful point. And I have to say, I think it's the first time I've heard that specific point being made. We have the same sort of pattern on the winner of the women's wheelchair race, Tatiana McFadden, I believe was her last name. If I've got that wrong, forgive me. But she was also she's a Russian immigrant who came to the United States as a young woman and won her second Boston marathon in a row on Monday. Jim, your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts, having friends who ran told me they cried for different reasons. It wasn't just about pain or this or that. It was actually some sense of relief, even psychic relief. And it goes to what Jeff was just saying, that, you know, you're making up for what was lost last year. You're reclaiming your city. But part of it was also reclaiming normality. You know, whatever you thought about the response with 9,000 federal, state, and local officials combing every single house, this is kind of reclaiming your space and saying, we've got it back. And I think that's a really important point to get back to the place we are, back to normality.
Okay, so, but how close are we really back to normality? Because we saw unprecedented security also on Monday. What was it, 100 new cameras along the 26-mile route of the marathon, both lots of uniformed and plainclothes cops, no more backpacks, clear bags, the whole deal. It's not the marathon that we're used to, Jeff.
Personally, I am never interested in being in the middle of a crowd with hundreds of thousands of people. I stayed away from the crowds in this one, just like I stay away from the crowds on the 4th of July down at the Esplanade. We will really be back to normality. I don't know that you're ever going to get rid of the cameras or that you're ever going to get rid of the extra police presence. I do hope that we'll get rid of the business. Apparently, the runners no longer had the transportation from Hopkinton of their own personal stuff.
Right.
They had whatever they wanted to have at the end, they had to schlep with them. It'd be nice if they could figure out a way to get rid of that. But I'll know that we are really back to normality when lots of us, including me, can go back to complaining about the fact that they have this thing on a work day on a Monday instead of doing it when it ought to be done on a weekend, when it's not going to destroy all the traffic and your ability to, you know, to cross Beacon Street and get to where you need to go.
Okay, so Jim, let me ask you about that, because I take Jeff's point. He doesn't like to necessarily go to any place where there's big crowds. But I do have to say that one of the things that always made me most passionate about the whole spirit of Marathon Monday was that it was this giant mass gathering of you and, well, on Monday it was a million of your neighbors, essentially. It did feel a little bit different, even though just about everybody, you know, agreed to it and cooperated with the new rules, the security rules. But it did have a slightly different feeling, like the thought that this is not the safe event that it once was in the air.
Oh, it absolutely was. And how couldn't it have been? Right. Right. We were essentially violated twice, once by what happened. And then people actually walking around our streets with tanks and driving around in tanks and walking around with submachine guns. Right. So whatever you think of that response, it's good to have the streets not look like that. Now, there are two things about that response. Everyone wanted to succeed. Right. Everyone wanted that day to go off without a hitch. You know, I have a feeling there are probably fewer drunk people out that day than there were usually. Right. Because everyone's really on their best behavior. And that was actually really awesome. I think it was really awesome. The other part of it, I take the point. There are tons of cameras and all that sort of stuff. I'm hoping that over time we can get back to a reasonable place where after a couple of years we can draw some of that back, because it is intrusive.
Mm-hmm. You know, think back to 9/11 and the post-9/11. To some extent, we're living with some of that stuff now. On the other hand, you don't, when you go to Logan Airport, you don't see what you saw during the first months afterward, which were, you know, the SWAT teams patrolling all the time very visibly. Yeah. And now they've even come up with this pre-check line. So
right,
don't
the
have
TSA
to take
pre-check,
your shoes off.
Exactly.
So, over time, let's hope.
So maybe a balance found over time. One more quick question about the marathon before we move on. And this is something that we've been discussing quite a bit here in our offices. And that's the level of media coverage over this first anniversary. You know, we have heard from listeners who said, great, you know, we love the fact that it was all over the newspapers and televisions and radios. We heard from other folks who said it was just too much, that it was, in fact, unbecoming of Boston. So, Jeff, let me ask
you
about
that. You know what? I feel it both ways. On the one hand, you know, the Boston Globe won a Pulitzer Prize this year for its amazing news coverage of you know, everything, that the bombing and all the aftermath. Enormous level of interest. There's clearly no question about that. And to the extent that, you know, all of us in one way or another are in the business of giving the market what the market, you know, craves, the interest, the media coverage, you know, fit that bill. On the other hand, I did find myself feeling a little bad for the people, or a little, you know, sad on behalf of the people in that town in Texas, which just a day after the bombing here suffered a far more lethal disaster, you know, when that chemical plant was
exploded,
destroyed.
Right, yeah.
Somehow I thought maybe, you know, a little bit more recognition that, awful as it was here and meaningful as the bombing was, you know, to Bostonians, other horrors should maybe get a little bit more attention as well.
But Megan, I mean, let's even bring it back closer to home. I think it was, the ceremonies were beautiful. But if you look at the 17 people who have been murdered so far, right, in Boston on Dorchester Ave, Callender Street,
right,
Tremont Street, Evelyn Street, to them, this likely looks like these lives that were lost were not as important as those lives. And I think we all need to spend a little more time when someone is murdered covering that in depth, because life is a beautiful and mesmerizing thing.
I totally agree with that.
On Monday we had, or 2 Mondays ago, we had a caller call in who said exactly that. He said, you want to see terror in Boston? It's there every single day if you look in terms of how some people in some neighborhoods continue to suffer with violence that's not as closely covered. So point taken on that. Let's move on to another story of this week, and that is all the legal wrangling over Zohydro, this powerful new hydrocodone-based painkiller. Governor Deval Patrick's administration has imposed new restrictions this week for prescribing Zohydro. Now, you'll remember that the governor tried to ban the drug or the prescription of the drug in the state altogether, but a federal judge overturned that ban last week, saying the governor had overstepped his bounds and his authority to do so since Zohydra has been approved by the FDA. Now, among the restrictions that the governor and his administration introduced this week, doctors now have to complete a risk assessment of patients and agree to a pain management treatment plan before prescribing the drug, which is 5 times stronger than most other opioid painkillers, and is crushable, meaning that it might be easier to abuse. So here's a little tape from State Public Health Commissioner Cheryl Bartlett.
Our first hope was that we could ban the use of this medication altogether, but second best is to have really good safeguards in place that so that there's safe prescribing.
All right, Jim, so let's start with you. Do you think the Patrick administration is taking the right steps, or are they still, according to some, overreacting to this new painkiller?
Trends in drug use are basically marketplace phenomenon. And that is, you know, you go back to the 70s, you have a lot of heroin smack and horse and all the rest. You get to the 1980s and you get crack and synthetic cocaine. It's driven by the cost and the access that people can get. There's been a 6-fold increase in production in synthetic heroin coming from Mexico. So it's all over the place. And it is a huge problem. If you look at the number of deaths in the United States, it is climbing fast. In Massachusetts, climbing fast. And addiction is climbing fast. So there is, I would say, something close to a public health emergency here. I don't know about the impact of that it's crushable. This, I don't know that in terms of the actual sort of technical stuff. I would say monitoring people, say doctors who are giving these prescriptions in terms of how many have you given out, I'm all for that. The bigger question I have, though, is this. What's your larger strategy? Mm-hmm. Like Kentucky, West Virginia, New Hampshire's filed legislation to put some clamp down on the use of this. But across state lines, you can get this stuff. So if you just ban it or you restrict it in Massachusetts, what does that mean? I'm not really sure. I think we're a little bit confused in the state. The FDA did approve this drug. I'm not saying I like the drug. They have never approved marijuana. No one's ever actually proved that it has a medicinal benefit. And yet we've decided to go forward with dispensaries. We clamped on this. I think we have some thinking to do about what we want to do with drug policy largely. But on this, given the emergency, I'm actually very comfortable with at least a portion of the restrictions because I do think you don't want doctors just giving this out willy-nilly. I mean, it seems to present a present danger.
Jeff, what do you think? I mean, there are a lot of people out there who says that that the government really shouldn't have any interference at all in terms of what doctors can and can't be prescribing to their patients.
I find myself a little bit conflicted here. On the one hand, there's something appealing to me always when a state government or the governor of a state resists the Washington approach, or says just because DC says X, Y, or Z doesn't mean we have to go along with that. There's that's the federalist impulse in me that likes the idea of states as laboratories that will the laboratories of democracy that will try different things. On the other hand, what pharmaceutical companies have to go through in this country to get a drug approved by the FDA is mind-boggling. Millions and millions of dollars that they have to spend to prove its efficacy, to prove its safety, years and years of testing that have to take place. I don't know the details about what's the name of the company that makes Zohydro? Something else?
Zogenix.
Zogenix. Yes. The details of what they had to go through to get this FDA approval. It's hard for me to believe that whatever those hurdles were, nobody through any of that thought about the things that the Patrick administration wanted to talk about. So that's number one. Number two, I guess I just generally resist the notion that because something is potentially dangerous, that therefore the solution is to ban it. The restrictions that the governor put out this week, or the Board of Registration and whatever it is put out this week, that apparently they had the legal authority to do all along, but that the initial impulse was to say, I'm going to ban it and then have to turn it to a federal lawsuit.
Right. Well, so that was absolutely shut down by a federal judge last week. But let me ask you, there's something that Jim said that I'm curious to get your thought on. And that is, Jim, and correct me if I got this wrong, but I want to be sure I get it right, that basically drug use and abuse it can be modeled as a market and with market forces involved. So, I mean, if that's the case, should there really be any interference whatsoever, any regulation, any, sort of guidelines from state government on things like prescriptions that have been approved by the FDA? Or did the, does the market regulate itself in this case?
Probably not. No, probably it doesn't regulate itself to that extent. I don't think either Jim or I is prepared to take, you know, an absolute hardline, you know, ultra-libertarian position when it comes to something that can cause death so
readily. How very dull.
I don't presume to speak for him. There's a difference between being so ideological and hardline that there's no idea concept of reasonableness. I think regulation is one thing, but to say nothing at all, I'm not sure that would be reasonable.
This is the point. Reasonable regulation, and I guess I mean it in a different way than you might think. If you are a heroin addict, you are not rational and you are not reasonable, and therefore the idea that somehow you're going to exercise freedom to me seems kind of odd. And I've seen people who've gone through heroin addictions for years. And it takes years to come out of what was perhaps a youthful mistake. So on this one, I'm all for regulating to make sure that people can remain rational human beings. And I don't think we should shy away from that.
But the question is, what's the larger strategy, as you said earlier?
Correct.
All right. Well, let's move on to news being made this week by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who has been making the rounds on national television and radio, promoting her new memoir, A Fighting Chance. Here she is talking about the struggles of middle-class Americans.
Today, it's a rigged playing field, and it's not working. Washington is not working for hardworking middle-class families.
But
so that's
Senator,
why I wrote this book.
Okay, so President Senator Warren has been asked time and time and time again, is this book an indication that you're going to run for president in 2016, to which she continuously swats it down and says, no. So, Jim Sturgis, your first response to the Warren media tour this week.
I'd say the release has been really smart. I work a lot in education, so a lot of the education circles saw this little blurb that came out that said, well, you know, I'm really for school choice, public school choice, and blowing up all the different school committees and having one big school district that kids can flow between. So she's trying to get traction out there. There are lots of details in there. I think the New Yorker put it this way. They said there's way too much peach cobbler and burned frying pans
right.
in the book. And
but regarding her personal story.
But what yeah. I mean, that's all political garnish, if you will. And that tells you something about the desire in the future to run. I'd say this. The book is too early in terms of its release for a run. Hillary Clinton's book is going to be coming out later this year. This is her ninth book, so I wouldn't read into that she's running. The next thing I'd say is, I think she's kind of positioning herself for what is Clinton-Bush fatigue. I mean, I think this country may decide at some point that 300 million people can do better than two family trees to provide the presidential candidates for the country. So I would say that she's someone who always sees her path clearly. This is not about 2016. This is about 2020.
Aha. Jeff.
She doesn't know if she's running for president yet, but she's certainly happy to have people talking about her running for president, which is why this campaign autobiography was just released. Listen, is she thinking about it? Here's some names. John F. Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, John Kerry. I'm just reading a little note I wrote.
Oh, okay.
John Kerry, Paul Tsongas, Mitt Romney, Mike Dukakis. You got elected to statewide office in Massachusetts, and by definition, practically, you start to see yourself as presidential material. Add to that the Adamses and, you know, the Lodge and, you know... Is it a campaign manifesto? So if you'll just indulge me for a sec, let me read you the last couple of lines in this book. All we want is a country where everyone pays a fair share, a country where we build opportunities for all of us, a country where everyone plays by the same rules and everyone is held accountable, and we have begun to fight for it. I believe in what we can do together and what we will do together. You tell me, is she running for something? Or does she want us to think that she's running for something?
But okay, let me jump in there.
Barack Obama had to be senator for two full years before he started his presidential campaign. She hasn't had two full years yet, so, you know.
Well, so here's my question. And in fact, the little excerpt that you read in your best Elizabeth Warren impression leads me to wonder, you know, in that same New Yorker article that you were talking about, Jim, the point was made that, you know, Elizabeth Warren has been writing scholarly and legal papers about her view on the basically the cost of indebtedness in the United States amongst the middle and lower classes for more, you know, two decades. But she went on the Dr. Phil show a couple years ago and reached, you know, millions more people in 20 minutes about this message than she ever did with her scholarly paper. So the argument was being made there that this book is in line with that, that it may have nothing to do with the presidential run, but rather a popularization of a whole body of research and work and, you know, personal conviction that Warren has had for years. I mean, Jim, your thought on that?
Well, the article also talked a lot about Louis Brandeis, and look where he ended up on the Supreme Court. So who knows what she's running for?
Listen, I'm not an Elizabeth Warren fan, but I can't deny that she has certainly struck a nerve, certainly on the, you know, the populist left. That odious video of her back when she was first running about nobody gets rich in this country on the road. You brought your goods to market on roads that we built. I mean, I think it was a terrible message, but an awful lot of people clearly love it. And, you know, she's got a following out there. This will add to that following.
You think that regardless of the run or not, she's getting a lot of traction then?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. But at the same time, there's also a lot of, you know, pushback. Her message, I think, appeals to a lot of people in this very polarized and divided country, and it repels a lot of people in this very polarized and divided country. And that's just the way politics in America works nowadays.
What about what Jim said earlier about the timing? Ignoring the presidential question, the timing of it regarding America's, Jim, as you said, fatigue with sort of the Clinton-Bush duopoly.
I share that fatigue. I will not vote for any ticket that's got a Bush on it. Nothing against Jeb or any of the others personally. I just don't think it's good for America. I won't vote for a ticket that's got a Clinton on it. Not that there was much danger of that happening. The talk about Chelsea Clinton's pregnancy as though this is something that Americans, you know, like it's the you know, what's her name in the Princess of Wales. You know,
oh, right.
Like the way they talk about, you know, royal families. It's just not healthy. And I don't know if we were always like this. I don't remember thinking of political families as the progenitors of all of our future leaders for the next three generations.
It's why we need to study history and read George Washington's farewell address, where he said, two terms is enough. I'm not a king.
All right. Well, we're under the wire here, so we've just got enough time left for our hubbubs. And those are the stories that may not have been above the fold, so to speak, or top of the newscast in our end of the business, but deserve a nod anyway. So, Jim, let's start with you. What's your hubbub?
Well, Anthony's not here, so he would have been shocked. I'm glad he's not going to be shocked. This is above the fold, under the fold, anywhere. But in a year when the marathon happily helped us forget about the Celtics basketball season, let us remember 49 years ago today that booming, opinionated Celtics player, later coach, and color commentator Tommy Heinsohn played his last game. It was 1965, the last game of the playoff finals. The Celtics won that 4-1 against the Lakers. He and Casey Jones, John Havlicek, and Bill Russell stepped off the court with a blowout win. It was the Celtics' seventh straight. That evening, he retired.
Huh.
49 years ago today, at the age of 30, people forget that he joined basketball. He was a rookie the same year that Bill Russell was a rookie, and he was Rookie of the Year, not Bill Russell. Six-time NBA All-Star. Basketball is full of giants. Tommy Heinsohn is one worth remembering, this year.
He must have read George Washington's farewell address and taken the message to
heart. Retired at the right time.
Well, his foot was kind of broken up.
Well, Celtics, great then. That's a great, great hubbub. Jeff, what about yours?
Well, my hubbub is nothing nearly so dramatic and memorable. In fact, it's not. It was definitely above the fold news, but on the other end of the country, so it doesn't count over here. Having talked about Elizabeth Warren and her, you know, one of her things when she ran for Senate was the People's Pledge and all this talk that we have about how, you know, restricting the amount of money that gets poured into campaigns. For all the people who continue to believe, against all the evidence, that the more money that can be spent in support of something that's on the ballot determines how the race will come out, I call our listeners' attention to a race to an election that took place in Seattle, in King County, Washington State, this week, where voters were confronted with Proposition 1 on the ballot, a proposal to increase to raise $130 million, half through a new sales tax or sales tax mm-hmm. increase, half through car registration for mass transit. A very liberal county out there, mass transit people love, highest numbers ever. The amount of money spent in support of those tax increases outweighed 85-1 the amount of money spent to oppose it. Every opinion leader was in favor of a yes vote. Vote for the tax increase. The papers, the politicians, everyone was in favor of it. The voters turned it down 55% to 45%.
Wow.
A decisive defeat for something, notwithstanding the fact that by a margin of 85-1, the money being poured into that race told them to raise their taxes. So there's hope for the common sense of the ordinary voter.
Or the enduring lesson that no matter how much you spend, it's hard to get other people to give up their own money. Well, my hubbub is a very short one, and that is the Fluffernutter may be on the path to become Massachusetts' official sandwich. I have to say that I have had one Fluffernutter in my life, and sorry to anyone who might be offended by this, that was one enough for me. But Jeff Jacoby, columnist for the Boston Globe, great to have you back, Jeff. Thanks so much. And Jim Sturgis, director of the Pioneer Institute, always great to have you.
It's good to be with you.
Gentlemen, both of you have a great weekend. And listeners, that's it for our Week in Review, but stick with us because there's a lot more of the show to come up. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.